TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Israel Lobby and the United Nations. Ian Williams.
Israel is the only state that was actually created by a UN resolution. So you have the conundrum that they have been busily denying the efficacy of the United Nations, its legitimacy, saying that the resolutions don't apply. But their very existence depends on a resolution. You hear continually a theme that General Assembly resolutions aren't binding. And we could say, amen, because it was a General Assembly resolution that partitioned Palestine and set up the Israeli state. There are refugees who will be going very, very hungry all across the Middle East soon because Donald Trump has defunded UNRWA, which, by the way, has been doing the Israelis a favor. They've been very ambivalent. They like to revile it to keep it off balance. But you have to remember that UNRWA has been doing what Israel should have been doing as the occupying power. UNRWA has been paying for the health and education of occupied Palestinians when the occupying power should have been doing it under the Geneva Convention. So the Israelis have known this all along, and they've reviled and shouted about UNRWA, but only so far. I think they are privately probably appalled that Trump has actually followed through on their bluff and cut the funding. No, we didn't mean it, Mr. President. We want the money, honestly. We just want to keep them under control.
Ian Williams has been Washington Report on Middle East Affairs United Nations correspondent since 1991. The Washington Report magazine, published 8 times per year, focuses on news and analysis from and about the Middle East and U.S. policy in that region. Williams has been a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian American Online and an editor for the World Policy Journal. He was one of the speakers at the annual conference organized by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. He spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on March 2, 2018. The theme of the conference was the Israel Lobby and American Policy. Speakers explored the different ways in which a powerful lobby for Israel, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, influences U.S. law, our Middle East policy, and our elections, steering the flow of donations to Israel-friendly members of Congress. They ensure, in return, the flow of foreign aid and weapons to Israel. Ian Williams spoke on the same panel as Virginia Tilley and Nora Erekat, who you might have heard in the 2 preceding programs on TUC Radio. Dr. Virginia Tilley is professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She's the author of The One State Solution, a pragmatic analysis of the two-state solution in Israel-Palestine, and editor of Beyond Occupation, Apartheid, Colonialism, and International Law in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Dr. Virginia Tilley argued in her presentation that the U.S. is supporting an apartheid state in Israel. Nora Erekat, in contrast, depicted Israel as a settler colonialist state. She's a noted Palestinian legal scholar, human rights attorney, and activist. She's an assistant professor at George Mason University. She said, "I want to urge us to think of this as settler colonialism first, a project that's distinct from colonization, in that the settler who moves into the colony has an intent to stay and replace the native. Just as U.S. settlers have forcibly removed the Native Americans. According to Israel, Palestinians don't exist as a people, and the territories belong to no sovereign. This is not occupation by law, nor, Erekat says, but an occupation by fact." Zionist forces in 1948 expelled an estimated 750,000 Palestinians from more than 500 villages and established a predominantly Jewish state. During the 1967 war, Israel seized the West Bank, Syria's Golan Heights, Gaza, and the old city of Jerusalem. Gaza, under siege by Israel now for more than a decade, has been described by international observers as an open-air prison for Palestinians, controlled by military checkpoints. In the West Bank, in violation of international law and the International Court of Justice, has been shot through with Israeli settlements in which more than 500,000 Jewish settlers now live and from which Palestinians are barred. As this program goes out for broadcast at the end of April 2018, the Palestinians that are held captive in the Gaza Strip are continuing their nonviolent campaign to focus the attention of the world on their plight. Since mass nonviolent protests started there on March 30, 2018, 39 Palestinians, including children and media, were shot dead, with thousands wounded by Israeli snipers. These snipers are in no danger and shoot from across the border fence, a grave violation of international law. Here's Janet McMahon introducing Ian Williams. Embedded in his talk is a reference to Israel potentially becoming a member of the United Nations Security Council. So stay tuned for more details in his talk. As this program is being produced, the decision has not yet been made. Janet McMahon.
Our next speaker, Ian Williams, is a native of Liverpool, England, and has been the Washington Report's UN correspondent since 1991. So it's no surprise that he really knows the ins and outs of that world body. He has twice served as president of the UN Correspondents Association and has won many awards for his exposés of UN malfeasance. At the same time, he has supported and defended the UN and its ideals, and has personally known four secretaries general, as well as numerous international diplomats and officials. Ian has been a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian American Online, and an editor for the World Policy Journal. A senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, he is the author of The UN for Beginners and the recently published Untold, The Real Story of the United Nations in Peace and War. Please join me in welcoming Ian Williams.
One of the big problems with the United Nations is people, what's it good for? And you know, I'm very diffident about this. I tell people it's the worst possible organization except all the alternatives. And it does work that way. If you start off with a sense of realism about what the United Nations can do, what it stands for, then you don't get disappointed too easily and you welcome its small successes. And there are successes and they're very relevant here. And there's a very good reason why Israel and its lobby concentrate so much on the United Nations. What Kofi Annan called the unique legitimizing power of the United Nations, we've seen several results of this recently. And Israel can never get clear title of Jerusalem or the occupied territories without a UN say-so. That's key. And it's actually been proven since 1945. If you think of the occupations, East Timor, everyone had given up on East Timor. The Indonesians, I actually told the foreign minister over lunch one day, you'll never get clear title, ever, until you can get the UN to do it, and the UN won't. So they fought it to a standstill in there, but in the end, East Timor is independent. Only this week, and I don't know whether you saw this, the European Court of Justice actually ruled that the European Union had no right to sign fishing treaties with Morocco that included Western Saharan fisheries. In effect, the European Court was legitimizing boycotts of produce from occupied territories. I think that one is something that should be played up a lot more. Yeah, because I know it's a contentious subject, but we've pointed out several times in Washington Report that there's a separation wall in Western Sahara as well as in Palestine, that there are many parallels there. The other one, of course, is Western Sahara will, in fact, sometime, even you never see a map where it's included in Morocco. The Moroccans cannot get clear title. And it's the same with the occupied territories and Jerusalem. And this brings us back to the ambivalence of Israel and the lobby. How should I put this? It's almost psychological, psychoanalysis. They have a deep respect for law. But in a sort of the Talmudic way that makes the elevator stop on every floor in the Sabbath so they can still take the elevator and obey the letter. Israel spends a lot of time trying to work its way around the laws. It very rarely completely denies them. So at the United Nations, they and the US spend a lot of time trying to create the sort of Sabbath elevator so that they can skirt within the law. But they are very scared of actual definitions of the law. That's why they are so upset. If the UN were ineffectual, they wouldn't devote so much effort to thwarting resolutions in there. And take Virginia's object, there is an apartheid convention. And it's like the genocide convention. There is a legal international binding commitment on member states to do something about an apartheid state. If Israel is declared to be an apartheid state or be practicing apartheid, there are legal consequences that states have to follow. In another regard, if you remember Jim Baker in Bosnia and the State Department were very, very solicitous to make sure the word genocide never appeared. You know, mass murder was fine. Mass murder is something that you can ignore. Genocide has a binding legal commitment under the Genocide Convention. You have to do something about it. So, you know, it looks like we're playing with words, but this is very, very serious. And the Israelis know that. For a start, they deny it, but in effect, Israel is the only state that was actually created by a UN resolution. So you have the conundrum that they have been busily denying the efficacy of the United Nations, its legitimacy, saying that the resolutions don't apply. But their very existence depends on a resolution. You hear continually a theme that General Assembly resolutions aren't binding. And we could say, amen, because it was a General Assembly resolution that partitioned Palestine and set up the Israeli state. So, you can see you could have a whole joint conclave of Jesuits and Talmud scholars to work your way out of this particular fine print, you know, where you're denying the basis for your own existence. It does have international complications because the United States was a founding member of the United Nations. It's still an indispensable part of the United Nations. It's inconceivable that the United Nations would exist without the United States taking part in it. And this creates severe problems because there's always the Israeli exception. Almost every law, every resolution that comes up is being weighed in the balance. Nuclear non-proliferation. The United States is signatory to non-proliferation treaties that say that no country apart from what is now the five permanent members should have nuclear weapons. And then it condones nuclear weapons in Israel. And because it does that, every other country in the world, India, Pakistan, North Korea, say, hey, if them, why not us? You're continually creating exceptions to your own rules that other people walk in through. The settlements in particular. The US has never actually approved them, but they've changed the language so often over the years that as far as the US is concerned, Jerusalem is international territory, the State Department. I believe, just showing this punctiliousness about law, I think I read earlier this year that the State Department is still refusing to issue passports with Jerusalem, Israel, to Americans born there. It's still Jerusalem. They won't put Israel on there. So the State Department does have some residual respect for international law that's missing from the White House completely. So let's get these territories together, because the UN is a sort of cockpit for all of these things. All human life is there. You're watching it. And you have this ambivalent attitude. Most American Jews, as we know, are liberal globalists. They support democracy and freedom. They like the United Nations. They made an exception because of all this stuff about Israel and Zionism as racism. They didn't think it through, but you know, it eroded the support. And this helped erode the support for the United Nations inside the US. The people who would automatically have been natural supporters of the UN were always ambivalent about it. You have Jewish senators from New York looking over their shoulders who will pass resolutions condemning the UN, cutting the funds. And that's one of the points that the lobby has been doing in Washington, is to try to trim the UN to size. by threatening to withhold funds, or actually withholding funds, or pulling out of organizations, as we've seen recently. And the effect of this isn't just financial. It is a continual sort of attrition of the morale and standing in the UN. We've seen secretary generals now who realize that to get on with the US, you have to pander to the Israel lobby. And all secretary generals have done this to some extent in a pragmatic political way. Kofi Annan was possibly the most accommodating up till then. Ban Ki-moon had a continual stream of the Jewish lobby organizations, B'nai B'rith, Conference of Presidents, that they were coming into his office all of the time. He always received them. They were banging on the door. They were also in the UN, and they were banging on the doors of embassies. All of these funny swing states, the microstates that only stamp collectors know about usually, will come up to support the US and Israel on these crucial resolutions. You know, the 2, 3, 6, the Pacific Trust territories, a few others, they come there. And this is a result of intensive lobbying by the Israel lobby here on these states to affect Israeli policy. At the moment, we have a particular situation coming. It would be almost laughable, except it's so serious. I don't know whether you know, but Israel is actually running for a seat on the Security Council this year. And, you know, on the face of it, this is laughable, but we have to remember that Morocco was on the Security Council while occupying Western Sahara. Indonesia was on the Security Council while it was occupying East Timor. Rwanda was on the Security Council while it was massacring its own population. You know, so it's not totally unprecedented. But usually they didn't actually say they're defying the whole gamut of international law openly. And is this likely to happen? I don't know. I don't want to get too much into it, but they're running for seat in the West European and Other group, which is an imperial sort of hangover, because essentially it is Europe plus the white Commonwealth, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, plus the US as a sort of ancillary member. And the Asians wouldn't have them. The Africans wouldn't have them. So in the end, intense lobbying by the lobby through the US came in and badgered the Europeans into accepting Israel as a sort of associate member so it could run for offices, which run on a rotatory basis. So Israel became a vice president of the General Assembly, became chairman of obscure committees. Would you believe the Israeli ambassador, I think, is chairman of the legal subcommittee at the moment, which is, it's like putting Casanova in charge of the chastity committee. Does not compute. This Israeli ambassador is actually very, very concerned about this bid. Then this was upgraded very quietly so that Israel became a full member. So it was allowed to run for the Security Council. And the mechanics of this is, regrettably, I mean, it's good for Western Europe, but most of the countries, the Security Council seats rotate on a Buggins' turn basis. You know, they have calendars going decades ahead sometimes of who occupies what position at the UN, which is why you get genocides in the Human Rights Committee, and now you may get Israel on the Security Council. And the reason for that is West Europe is the only one that actually has elections. And if they don't decide within their own group, then it goes to a general poll of all the members to who becomes a temporary member of the Security Council. So Germany and Belgium are the current candidates, and Israel is running against them. And I've been trying to sort of calculate the odds on this. It's difficult. I can imagine there are Israeli ambassadors, the Israeli diplomats going into Berlin and saying, you owe us so much. Why don't you do the right thing? Why don't you stand down and let us run? How could you deny us? Do you want to compound your crimes? And the Germans will say, well, we'll give you another submarine. Shut up. We're taking this one, I suspect. But I am worried about Belgium. The other people will gang up on Belgium and say, you should stand down and do the right thing. Because that's the only way to get in. If it goes to an open poll, Israel isn't going to get it. But if it's done with a stitch-up like this, if Belgium is leaned upon sufficiently by the other powers, it might just do it. So it's worth watching and it's worth intervening. What's the practical effect? A lot. you know, discussions in the Security Council, they do end up crucial, the resolutions that come through. Even a temporary member in there can have considerable effect. You know, while France was grandstanding over the Iraq War, it was the other smaller countries with the respect for international law, like Jamaica and Ireland and others like that, who actually provided the bulk of the opposition to the Iraq War in there and stood their ground. Where do we get to with this ambassador? And I think this is where it brings the lobby in as well. Because the UN is so unpopular in some parts of America, like the evangelical Christians, or with the diehard Zionists, it's a great fundraising gamut. I keep getting letters from various organizations saying, poor little Israel, the only country not allowed to be on the Security Council. Poor little Israel, continually victimized at the United Nations, send a check. And I think it's one of the dynamics, I think Grant touched on it before, is these organizations are businesses. They're self-sustaining businesses, so they want checks off people. And if they can find an issue at the United Nations, they can raise money on the strength of it, and they do. But then it has a practical effect, because secretary generals, UN staff get pilloried, they get harassed to do the right thing. And we've seen that with the reports that have been squashed. You know, they'll just get dropped, or they'll be sidelined. I mean, look what happened to poor Arthur Goldstone. Now, he was personally harried into the ground until he gave up. I felt he was almost a tragic figure by the end, because he started off with such integrity. But with the US, it's even worse, because it destroys the whole basis of the United Nations. The embassy move is in direct defiance of the UN Charter. The US, the founder and drafter of the UN Charter. When the UN Charter was flown from San Francisco to Washington, the case had its own parachute. Al-Jahis, who was carrying the case, didn't have a parachute. I think maybe they knew something or suspected something. But, I mean, that was how seriously the US took the UN at the time. And this is setting at naught international law. I mean, this is the significance of it. Donald Trump has basically ripped up the UN Charter. And then because we're talking about people who can believe three impossible things before breakfast, like the Red Queen in Alice, they are now saying, but Iran is in defiance of UN resolutions. Therefore, we must take action against it. Because that's the other fulcrum at the moment. The case for a war against Iran is being made in the United Nations. Our current ambassador, Nikki Haley, there, is, I mean, she should get her credentials from Tel Aviv. I was going to say, not Jerusalem. Because I've never heard her say anything that isn't 150% in support of Israel. She really is. I mean, she's devoted her full time there, and she gets there and pledges in. It gets down to the actual reason why the lobby is so important for these people. You want power in Washington, it goes through the lobby. You want to be president in the United States, as the US ambassador to the UN most assuredly does, you go through the lobby. They will jump through any hoops at all to do it. And that risks the organization, which for all its faults, it's a major but pragmatic conclusion. You may look at the UN and say it's a failure, but as people in there will tell you, we haven't had World War III yet. Yes, that's the measure. But this is the road to World War III. If you dissolve the whole structure of international global law and security, that's where we're going. And that's what Donald Trump has started, and he's done it on behalf of the lobby. He's done it because all across this country, people are writing checks to congressmen, persuading them to vote in defiance of international law and to vote to revile the United Nations. There are refugees who will be going very, very hungry all across the Middle East soon because Donald Trump has defunded UNRWA, which, by the way, has been doing the Israelis a favor. They've been very ambivalent. They like to revile it to keep it off balance. But you have to remember that UNRWA has been doing what Israel should have been doing as the occupying power. UNRWA has been paying for the health and education of occupied Palestinians when the occupying power should have been doing it under the Geneva Convention. So the Israelis have known this all along, and they've reviled and shouted about UNRWA, but only so far. I think they are privately probably appalled that Trump has actually followed through on their bluff and cut the funding. No, we didn't mean it, Mr. President. We want the money, honestly. We just want to keep them under control. So they have kept them under control to a large extent. They've kept Secretary General after Secretary General under control to some extent. But it still comes back to it. Ban Ki-moon had all of these people from all of the Israeli organizations coming in. But he always, once he'd been to Gaza and saw what was happening in Gaza, that was the key. The Israelis tried to stop him going to Gaza. As soon as he got there, you see all of his statements, he stated very clearly the UN positions about occupation, about Gaza. And so, yes, he kept receiving them, but then he would tell them, you've got to break the siege. You cannot keep on doing this. You've got to end the occupation. And Guterres is in the same position. He's instinctively pro-Israeli, like a lot of European social democrats. But he is now telling them, gently, you've got to. But the terrible thing is, as long as the US is 100% behind Israel, and as long as the lobby keeps it that way, then the UN is never going to be a functioning international body in a complete way, which is bad news for the world, all of us, on every level. You know, whether it's climate change or whatever. It is an indispensable organization. I'd better wind up. Go and sit down. Thank you very much.
That was Ian Williams. He spoke on the topic of the Israel lobby and the United Nations. Williams has been Washington Report on Middle East Affairs United Nations correspondent since 1991. He has been a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian American Online and an editor for the World Policy Journal. Williams is the author of The UN for Beginners and the recently published Untold, The Real Story of the United Nations in Peace and War. He was one of the speakers at the annual conference organized by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. He spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on March 2, 2018. Videos and transcripts of the conference can be found via the website of IRMAP, short for Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, or on the website of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.